Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Parsha class for Parshas Naso 5765. And also, we're on the eve, almost, of Shavuos. Today is the beginning of the 3 days called Shloshes Yimei Hagbala, the 3 days of the border, literally, which is referring to the fact that the Jewish people were given instructions prior to the giving of the Torah on the sixth day of Sivan to prepare themselves. And one of the ways they prepared was to set a boundary so as not to get too close to the mountain. So these days are really welcomed with great joy and anticipation. The Shloshes Yimei Hagbalah, there are those who have the custom, after observing the restrictions of mourning during the period of Omer, second half, to relax those restrictions at the beginning of the 3 days. Today is the first of those 3 days. Tomorrow, Shabbos, will be the second, and then Sunday will be the third, Erev Shavuos, the day before. So we sit here both preparing ourselves for the Parsha of Naso and also preparing ourselves for the day of Shavuos, which is the great day of the giving of the Torah. And thanks to our Rebbe, Rav Yerucham Lvovitz, from whom we have been learning and becoming enlightened and nourished by his wonderful words of Torah and Musar, he gives us a commentary on one of the topics of this Parsha, which really implicates the entire acceptance of Torah in a beautiful way. And it is a pleasure to be able to try to give over some of these words. The section in Parshas Naso, which he addresses, is the section dealing with the Nazir, the Nazirite. Actually, there is a famous comment by Rashi, quoting the sages, as to the juxtaposition of the two sections that are back-to-back. The one before Nazirite is the Sota. That's in chapter 5. And then comes chapter 6, the Nazirite. So what's the connection? The Sota is the story, or is the law, concerning a woman, a wife, who was being suspected by her husband to be having an affair with another man. And the husband had warned her, and she violated the warning, and she was seen in seclusion with this man. And the husband suspects her, but he's unable to prove it. Definitively, the Torah instructs him on how to settle the matter in a divine way. He brings her to the temple, and the Kohen administers a certain potion of water and the holy name of God. It's a whole process which we're not going to go into now. And by drinking this potion, it will be determined divinely whether she is guilty or not. And this way, the marriage will be settled one way or the other. But following that intricate set of laws, there is another section which deals with a totally different law, mitzvah, and that is the mitzvah of Nazir. Nazir is an individual, man or woman, who wishes to take upon him or herself further restrictions than those otherwise required by the Torah. Basically, to abstain from drinking wine or anything resembling wine. That's the primary restriction, and then it's also accompanied by not cutting of the hair and also by not being contaminated to the dead. So Rashi raises a question which is asked by the sages in the Talmud. What is the connection between the Sota and the Nazir? Between the section dealing with the unfaithful wife and the Nazirite, if any? And the answer is given. And this was well known. This was very frequently. I had mentioned a story about our Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Ruderman, of blessed memory. He used to quote this phrase from Rashi often, and I'll tell you what he said about it. Rashi says, "Lama nismucha parshas nazir la parsha sota?" Why is the section of the nazir written right after the section of the sota? "Lomar lacha," to teach you. Shekol haroes sota bikilkula, anyone who beholds a sota, a woman, the unfaithful woman, being condemned, being disclosed, having committed an unfaithful act, yazir atzmo min hayayin, this person is recommended to become a nazir. This person who has seen the destruction, the breakdown of morality of this woman, he is a candidate, prime candidate, to become a nazir. So the whole rationale behind this needs explanation. What is the connection? Somebody sees a very destructive woman who not only did she fall into temptation, but she openly violated her husband and in an act of rebellion. Why? I saw her. I saw this lowly person. I should become a nazir. I should take upon myself further restrictions. What does one have to do with the other? In fact, says Rav Yerucham, human tendency, when watching a person who has plummeted to such depths, is to dismiss it and to kind of laugh it off and say, "Oh, look at them! Look how low they've become." Disassociating oneself from that behavior, almost as if there's no comparison. I didn't realize the difference day and night between myself and that other person. I didn't realize that person was so lowly. Why should I be threatened in my own morality to the point that I feel I must take on additional restrictions, as if to say that maybe I have a problem? The sages, what they mean is, it says, I better stay away from wine, because wine very often brings people to a state of levity and looseness, relaxes their guard, and could lead a person to immoral behavior. As if to say, now that I've seen her, I have to beware of not falling to her level.
Is that a wayward wife?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't it suspect her at all and says, well, gosh, she did it. That could have been me. And maybe you need to put a fence around that from happening.
You know, you could say that, but I think human nature, Rabbi Yerucham says human nature, is to just do the opposite. To say, I'm totally removed from that person. That's just not me. Why is there a reaction, the opposite, that I, now that I've seen it, I must take special guard?
Examine their own feelings. Examine his own feelings. Might not consciously think of any trespass per se, but perhaps subconsciously. Is he sure that he's so pure?
Okay, but he could do that anytime. Why do that now that he's seen? If anything, that should strengthen his resolve not to fall into that.
Because he's thinking about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does Rashi comment on why he says that?
No. He doesn't give the rationale as to why this is an opportune time for him to become a nazir. I'll tell you. Okay. Let me finish the train of thought, and we'll take questions afterwards. I just want to mention, Rabbi Ruderman used to say this often, and he didn't address the question of what the rationale is. Rabbi Ruderman did not address the issue of the rationale, but he did used to say that we see from here that if one is inspired, but one does not take action to concretize and solidify the inspiration will dissipate. This person has seen the sota. In whatever mechanism in his mind, he has a moment of realization or inspiration. He's got to do something about it. He's got to adopt Nazirism for himself or something. Otherwise, if he just thinks about it and he says, wow, what a realization, that will dissipate. Feelings, inspiration dissipates. Resolutions, taking action based on inspiration, is something that will have a lasting effect. And so he used to always say, we have the privilege, the opportunity to study Torah every day here at the yeshiva, and we're constantly coming upon words of inspiration. He says, but if we don't take action, if we don't act upon it, if we don't accept upon ourselves to do something better, to improve, to spend more time, or to stop this or that, then whatever we learn is just going to go into one ear and out the other. So that was his message. His message was, and this is really a Musar principle, that learning has to be followed by resolution, by action, in order to make it last. In any case, let's turn back to the rationale of this strange reaction. You see a sota, become a nazir. So Rav Yerucham says the following. He says that the sages don't look at the human being in this totally innocent way that I just described earlier. The innocent way of, well, I'm not like that. The sages know that deep inside the human being is potential for tremendous good and for tremendous evil. We've discussed this before on occasion. Ramchal's formula, Rabbi Luzzatto, about how God created man with an equal balance between good and evil forces, both within and without, and actually it became stronger, imbalanced after the sin of Adam and Eve. We have it within us. He gives an analogy. It's kind of a crude analogy, but I guess he does it to make the point. I'll try to modernize it. You walk into a beautiful home, and you're taking a tour of the home, and you see all the beautiful rooms with all the furnishings and the draperies and the wall coverings. You see the living room, the beautiful furniture. You see the kitchen with the most up-to-date features. You go into the bedrooms. And then, of course, the person of the house will say, you've got to see our bathroom. We walk into the bathroom, and we see the latest plumbing fixtures and the marble sink tops and the beautiful wallpaper and the tile up and down and the trimmings around the... What's the bathroom for?
What
do you mean? Bathroom is to cover, is to house the excrement. Really, this room is a place for depositing human waste. And yet, the bathroom, we have discovered a way to hide it, to cover it, to flush it, to the point where we actually take pride in the way our bathroom looks. But really, if one knows what's going on there, they realize that it's just a cover-up. We've gotten away, thank God, from the outhouses, where it wasn't so easy to cover it up. But that's what it is. The human being is very similar. We have within us not just the potential, but we also have a lower side. And what we have been trained ourselves to do, and some do it better than others, is to create a mask and to cover over the lower, the baser side of our nature and our thoughts. And everybody has it within them. Of course, it is possible for us to truly purify our thought process and to purify our actions to the point where we start to use the accolade the sages sometimes use, toho kibaro. His inside is like his outside. That's a beautiful, beautiful achievement. There was actually, in the Talmud, there was one of the rabbis who had a yeshiva. And he was very strict entrance requirements. You had to be toho kibaro. Your inside had to be as pure and as well-meaning as your outside. He didn't want people that were just trying for fame and glory, or to learn how to dispute or debate. He only wanted students that were toho kibaro. And therefore, he had a very small yeshiva.
Yeah.
Of course, the obvious question is, how does he know? How was he able to see? I heard one answer is that it was simple. He just kept the yeshiva door locked, and there was basically no way to get in. If you were very, very determined and sincere, you would scan the building all the way around, and there was one like open window that you could climb in. And he figured that if only if a person was toho kibaro would he find his way in. If the person didn't want to get in that much, he would turn away. All right, that's one explanation. But in any case, toho kibaro is possible, is achievable, but it's a lifetime of work, and not everybody reaches it. And quite frankly, one does not have to be ashamed for the excrement that lies within, because that's how we were made. But what we are expected to do is to create a cover-up, and that's perfectly respectable. we create. It's not a facade. It's actually like putting reins on the wild horse so that the wild horse doesn't break loose and cause damage. We have the ability to restrain ourselves, to control ourselves, our thoughts, and certainly our actions, our words, and that is really our job. Our job is to maintain a good cover-up for the excrement. Now, this individual, this person who has beheld the sota, he has just seen someone blow their cover. He has just beheld how an individual did not restrain him or herself and allowed the garbage to emerge and to actually take over his life and to make a decision to act upon their internal workings. This person now becomes shocked that everyone has this cover and everybody has this ability to restrain himself, but they also can blow it. They can lose. They can blow the cover. And we all know what happens when the plumbing doesn't work. Then all of a sudden, the bathroom is no longer a pleasant room to be in. And at that moment, a person has to realize that nobody is beyond. Nobody is above this. Because the reason why we think we're so far beyond it is because we have a tight cover on ourselves. And we know how to keep restraint. But when you see the capacity of a human being to blow his or her cover, it's shocking, and it causes a person to pause and reflect that if I wouldn't hold on to my cover, I could do the very same thing. It's within me. And therefore, that does require that shock, that realization that we could blow our cover, requires us to take action. And as Rabbi Ruderman said, don't just think about it and be inspired and be say I'll be smarter, but to actually take measures. Let me pause for a moment and just take some brief comments or questions about this before moving on to the next idea. Yeah, Dr. Ruderman. Yeah.
To look at it another way. I mean, at first it's called the bathroom, not the toilet room.
Mm-hmm.
It's the place where actually you wash away the dirt that clings to you and purify yourself.
Okay.
And the sota only applied to women.
Yeah.
She couldn't charge her husband with sending him there. The husband can only charge the woman.
Don't forget that that is not adulterous in Torah law for a man to have another wife. Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a wine. You know,
yeah.
Not to argue with.
Yeah.
Rough.
Well.
You know, the analogy isn't.
Okay. All right. Very fair. Yes.
So here's my question. The whole basic idea is that you're blowing off the cover, and like you were talking about how Ramchal talked about, how you have this physical body, and you have this high spiritual flow, and the idea that they come together is stellar, and it's incomprehensible, the fact that you have this soul created by God, nurtured in the higher world, and it's brought into a body that carries on its own excrement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you have someone at the sota, like it blows off the cover, and then you're giving in to the lower part, and it's actually a betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
To your higher soul. And if you think about the sota, it's a betrayal to the husband's soul as well.
Sure.
So would this not apply to Lashon Hara as well, which is the actualization of physicality from your spirit? And, like, it's the path that your spirit can manifest itself in this world. Isn't that a betrayal to Hashem? Should someone become a nazir based on, if they see someone who's just ridiculous with slander and Lashon Hara? I mean, is it the same concept? And if so, where do you draw the line as far as ideologically as to what type of sins that you see that would cause you to have to internalize the message to the degree that you become
another. I assume that you're asking because there is a statement by Chazal that says that, you know, just as we're familiar with the idea that Torah study is the equal to all of the positive commandments. There's also a statement that says Lashon Hara is equivalent to all of the negative commandments, and therefore you're saying Lashon Hara would seem to be the worst. And so if you become you have to become a nazir for this, why not for that? I hear the question. You know, it is not as the Talmud does say that everybody falls into avak Lashon Hara at least, and only miyutan be'arayos, only a small percentage of people fall into the grips of immoral you know, sexual behavior. So it could be just because of the shock value. It's true, it is very destructive to say Lashon Hara, but it doesn't have the same shock value because doesn't seem to be such a aberration of human behavior, Lashon Hara, as much as Arayos, as immoral behavior. So it could be that. Yes,
how does Jeff? The blessing from the Kohanim fit into this?
That is another good question, which is the section after the Nazir. I don't have an answer for that one.
You know,
not now. I may have seen it in the past, but I don't remember it.
Thank you.
What I'm going to say next is really how Rabbi Rucham says we really could take this perspective on the whole Torah. Rabbi Rucham says, let's take this paradigm of the Sota and the Nazir and let's expand it to really look at the entire Torah. Knowing that we have, that the human being has the capacity for great development and also for very destructive development. Let's turn our attention to Kabbalas HaTorah, the Jews receiving the Torah, being offered the Torah, and let us see what was being offered to us at that time. He makes the following observation. When we study the section, chapter 19 in Shemos, in Exodus, which is the chapter that precedes the Ten Commandments, we see that there was an important dialogue between God and the Jewish people through Moshe, where Hashem was actually asking us to accept the mission. And there's also a famous response that the Jewish people said, we will do it. What was it that God was asking of them? I'll just read a few of the verses near the beginning of chapter 19. Moshe ascended to God, and Hashem called to him from the mountain, saying, so shall you say to the house of Jacob and relate to the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to Egypt, and that I have borne you on the wings of eagles and brought you to me. And now, if you hearken well to me and observe my covenant, you shall be to me the most beloved treasure of all peoples, for mine is the entire world. You shall be to me a kingdom of ministers and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the children of Israel. Those phrases, Mamleches Kohanim v'goy Kadosh, a kingdom of Kohanim, of priests, of ministers, and a holy nation. Just as we have Kohanim in our ranks, we as a whole people, are a kingdom of Kohanim vis-a-vis the rest of the world. Eila Hadvarim, these are the words that you should speak to B'nai Israel. Rashi says, these words, no more and no less. Lo pachos v'lo yoser. Says Rav Yerucham, Hashem was telling Moshe, I don't want you to go and give them a list of the commandments now. That's not what I am asking them to consider. I want you to ask them one simple question. Do you accept upon yourselves to be a mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh? Do you wish to be accept the mission of being a kingdom of priests vis-a-vis the other nations of the world and a holy nation, a nation of people that are kadosh, not destructive, not lowly? Do you wish to accept that? Moshe came down and summoned the elders and laid those words out in front of them. No more, no less. The entire people responded together and said, everything that Hashem has spoken, we shall do. Yes, we accept the mission. It doesn't say that they said, what are the commandments? It doesn't say that they asked, what are we going to have to do? They just said, yes, we accept that mission. That is the essence of Kabbalas HaTorah, of accepting of the Torah. Not accepting the particular commandments, but accepting the mission. Now, if one accepts a mission like that, it is well understood that one will have to go through the steps needed to become that. He gives several examples. He says, if you tell somebody, would you like to be a millionaire? Who wants to be a millionaire? So we might say, yeah, I do. Now we know that the person is not offering to hand me $1 million. They say, would you like to be a millionaire? And if we say yes, then we understand that we are committing ourselves to do what it takes to make $1 million. or if a person wants to become a certain profession, craftsmanship. Let's say a person wants to be a tailor. It presumes that we have dexterity with our hands, that we have good eyesight, that we have the ability to follow instructions and to be precise in our work. And then we're going to have to train with a master tailor and to learn all the steps and all the different stitches. That goes without saying. I cannot be a tailor if I don't accept all the steps required to become one. And therefore, when Hashem says to the Jewish people, become a holy nation, it is understood from there that we have to go through the steps of holiness. So, for example, it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah you have to have good midos. Not really. You have to have good character traits. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah, don't be an angry person. Don't be a stingy person. Don't be a mean person. Don't be grouchy. It doesn't say those kind of things in the Torah. Why not? Because it goes without saying. That's like, how could I be a tailor if my fingers don't work? We realize that there's a lot more to it than just having dexterity. We have to train. And we know that the mitzvahs are going to come. But essentially, what we're accepting is the product, to be a holy nation. The mitzvahs are just the tools that we're going to use to become qualified holy people. And the reason why they're important is because of this. To become holy means that we have to learn, like the Nazir, we have to learn how to restrain and control and to cover up the bad nature within us. So in this way, he has connected. He said, Nazir is an extreme. It's an example of somebody going above and beyond what the law requires. Sometimes the Torah gives us an opportunity of being a super Jew. But without being a super Jew, just to be an ordinary Jew, and Shavuos is the time to reaffirm that, what we are accepting is the mission. The mission is to become holy, to become a unique nation, a nation devoted to pronouncing the oneness of God in the world and to living in a higher standard, a standard of holiness, a standard of transcendence from the lower, like you said, the lower world. And based on that, it goes without saying that all of the necessary training will have to come. That is the essence of being a Jew. Not, Jews do this and they don't do that, and they pray three times a day and they don't work on the Sabbath. And it's not a list of to-dos. That would be like saying a tailor is someone who puts needles into material and pulls thread, etc. You say a tailor is someone that produces beautiful clothing. A Jew is someone who sanctifies and purifies himself. A Jew is someone who follows particular commandments and restrictions on how to cover up the evil side and to subdue it and to hopefully rise above it. This is what being a Jew means, and this is really the essence of Kabbalah HaTorah, of receiving the Torah, not so much receiving this mitzvah, that mitzvah, that mitzvah, but receiving the mission of being Mamlechas Kohanim, the Goy Kadosh. So that is just a thought, an inspiring thought to me of what Kabbalah HaTorah is, that in fact the Nazir and the Sota is a paradigm teaching us what we have the capacity for, both on the good side and the bad side, and how it requires vigilance. And the Torah basically is a program how to produce, and it's the only way that it works. The only way to produce a holy people, a holy person, really, is to follow the instructions. This is the training course to becoming that holy people. Wish everybody a good Shabbos and a good Yom Tov, and we'll hope to meet again next week.
You know, on the part about...
Yeah. Steve, you want to go first?
The Sota was saying about the Egyptians were claiming that they had their way with the Israeli women. And when they got to the waters of Marah,
yeah.
They all the women had to do that process. They drank the water, and that they all came out not guilty.
Clean. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where were they 9 months later? That means they all had a baby. There must have been a big population increase back at 9 months later, wherever they were.
Well, Egypt had a great population increase with six babies born at a time.
Well,
yeah.
Before where they accepted the Torah, though, before that, though, they were given a list of mitzvot. They were given a sort of sample of what it was going to be like. They did get the mitzvot of Shabbos and other things.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, but they got a sample.
That's true.
They're saying that we accept the sort of new...
Well, we knew that mitzvot were part of it. It's obvious, you know, just like any profession, it's obvious that you've got to undergo training. Just that the question is, you know, how much and how many. But it could be that God wanted them to start practicing some of these things in advance. But they hadn't not yet committed to the whole package.
And you said that, you know, these 3 days are sort of like the 3 days they prepare the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
In the Torah, one of the instructions is come not near a woman.
Yes.
Does that pertain?
Interesting.
Does that pertain to anything?
Interesting, yeah.
Before getting the
Ten Commandments, they had to separate men and husbands and wives. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they probably had to be like kind of like Yom Kippur, you know, in a sense of being totally single-minded and.
Yeah, but you said how people today sort of get in that frame of mind, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. Halacha does not require that husbands and wives separate up until Shavuos. No, does not. Even on, it's customary actually, on holidays, the beginnings of holidays, like Shavuos, beginning of Pesach, for couples not to engage in relations. It is not law other than on Yom Kippur. But on the other days, it's customary. But it's
why?
Not. Why? The custom, I think, comes from the idea of being focused on the work of the special work of the holiday. To be, you know, be more focused. Yeah.
This message is really, you know, beautiful about the dichotomy of a human and this idea of what the Torah is supposed to have us do.
Mm-hmm.
Why, usually, if this wasn't a leap year, this would come after Shavuot, right?
Oh, you're saying sometimes Naso comes
message.
Afterwards.
Well, it's a beautiful message.
I see. Why isn't Parshas Naso, according to Rav Yerucham, it's such a basic Shavuot message, it should always come out before Shavuot, and often it isn't. No, maybe the year that he gave this lecture, it was before Shavuos, and he felt that he had to tie it in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if not, listen, if we hear it right after Shavuos, it's also good.
Yeah. And why are there 2 days Shavuos?
Why are there 2 days Shavuos?
By now, the messengers telling us when Rosh Chodesh Nisan was have arrived.
Yeah.
Right? If you go with the one that says this is, because the messengers had to tell you when it's Rosh Chodesh.
Good question.
Well, for Shavuos, all you need to know is when Rosh Chodesh Nisan was.
It's
already 2 months ago.
In fact, to strengthen your question, it's the one holiday that's not given a calendar day.
That's right. So
that's a good question.
Yeah, so why do we have 2 days? You know, then it shouldn't feel slighted compared
to the
other one.
So the spiritual non-halachic answer is that the reason why Jews in the diaspora celebrate 2 days of Yom Tov is because they need the actual dose of Yom Tov to compensate
then,
for the lack of
the question,
closeness to Israel.
When we count the Omer, then, why don't we count the Omer where we read on the Chol Hamoed Sukkot, you know, you read the sacrifices, you read 2 days' worth because you don't know which day it might be.
Yeah.
So how do we know that today is actually the 47th day of the Omer?
Why didn't we say 47th or 46th?
Because Shavuos could be second day Shavuos.
Yeah. The post can discuss this question. They basically say that Sfiras Omer would be a conflict to the whole concept of Sfiras Omer if we wouldn't be sure what day we're counting.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Izuri.
Question I had, or anyway, I heard something to answer your question, Jeffrey, about the Kohanim, the relationship in the Parsha between. Why is it in the Parsha about the Kohanim? And
oh, yes, yes.
Following the
Did
purity,
you read a commentary on that?
Yesterday I heard from Rabbi Avi.
Yasher Koach.
He read it from a commentary. Forgive me, I can't remember the source, but he discussed this question, and he said that to show that a Yisrael can achieve a higher level even than a Kohen, because a Kohen can see the mate if it's his father or mother, except for, I think, the Kohen Gadol, I think,
right,
the regular.
Right.
But a Nazir cannot even see to the funeral, you know, to be in the presence of father or mother, to show that a regular person, that we're all Kohanim in a certain way, and that this level the person can achieve whatever,
even
but
higher,
afterwards he has to make a sacrifice, because he shouldn't have to do all this you know, he should feel almost guilty that he has to bring himself to do all this hardship on himself, because he has to. So there has to be a sacrifice given, because otherwise the question is asked: you give a sacrifice only after an avera.
What was the avera?
What was the avera? So the avera was that he had to bring himself to this abstaining from the ability to be with people and do mitzvahs, and we're supposed to, like, we're supposed to be alive to do good things, not separate ourselves and say we're going to be like a guru in the Himalayas and you know, achieve some kind of perfection without being in society to do mitzvahs. So
it's like a necessary evil. In other words, it's ideally we shouldn't be Nazirim.
Right.
We only do it because we need to. I think there's a story that there is only one like really well-meaning Nazir, according to one rabbi. Yeah. The other ones were doing it kind of for maybe haughtiness. Shimshon was made a Nazir by his parents, so he didn't.
Shmuel,
it was not.
There was
another
one. I think there was
Shimshon and Shmuel. Yeah, Shmuel maybe also. But he said, this one rabbi in the Talmud says, I would never eat of a korban brought by a Nazir, because I always doubted his motives. There was one that I met, and he told me why he became a Nazir, and it was completely for the right reasons, and it's the only korban that I partook of. And I kissed him on his forehead, and I told him, may all Nazirim be like you. But unfortunately, many became Nazirim for other than perfect motives. What? No, not in my day. Okay, thank you very much, and have a wonderful Shabbos and Yom Tov.